Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. The music you're hearing is a tribute to Toots Thielemans. Toots Thielemans, the master harmonica player, one of the great, great musicians. He died at age 94 this week in Brussels, his home. And we're going to be playing Trevor Young, our producer, has picked out some Toots Thielemans songs to honor him.
Have we got theme from Midnight Cowboy?
Did he do that?
Yes, he did.
Oh, Jim, where were you when we needed to load the music into the show? We will play a little Toots Thielemans because he was really a wonderful musician. Jim Galloway, you just heard from, of course, he is the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. You read his column in the Thursday and Sunday Dead Tree editions of the paper, and he just announced that he doesn't have a lead yet for the column that comes out tomorrow. Jim, get to work.
I know.
We look forward to reading the column and seeing what you come up with. Greg Bluestein, who is a political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and a frequent member of our panel, thank you for being here again today.
Glad to be here.
And I'm really thrilled that joining us by Skype from Athens is David Hazinski, professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. He specializes in digital and electronic journalism out there. David, of course, a longtime correspondent for NBC Network News. But David, how long have you made your home out there in Athens working at UGA?
I've been here about happy years.
How many? Say it again.
30 years.
30. Oh, my gosh. Okay, so David, you are you're part of the older brain trust that we try to put together on this show. Thanks so much, David, for being with us.
Happy to be here. I think I'm amidst august company.
We're going to, in a few minutes, and certainly I want you to weigh in throughout the show. We're going to talk a little bit about the state of journalism in the race this year, and we'll look forward to hearing your feedback on that. But before we get to that, Jim, let's talk about the gathering in Macon yesterday as it relates to state politics. You were down there for the annual Georgia Chamber of Commerce luncheon.
Right.
And it was, as it often is, there were a lot of politics involved.
Oh, yeah. This is kind of when the political center of Georgia moves down I-75 and into Macon over at the Coliseum. They generally pick out members of Congress to kind of highlight. At this time, it was Johnny Isaacson, of course. I mean, they're four square behind him. They've already endorsed him. There are very few kind of Democratic elected officials. There are a few, but not too many. What was interesting, I thought, it wasn't just what Isaacson said, but what the people who talked about him said.
Yeah.
We had David Perdue up there, his the junior senator from Georgia now, and I mean he kind of praised he called Isaacson our Howard Baker, you know, which is interesting. I mean
Howard, a guy who knows how to reach across party lines.
Right, he was the deal maker of the 1970s and 1980s into the Reagan era, and he says when did compromise become such a dirty word?
Very interesting for a senator who so far has made it clear he is firmly in the Republican camp up there on the Hill. I'm not terribly interested in reaching out to Democrats.
He is very, very much a Trump supporter. Every other word out of his mouth, sometimes it seems, is outsider. And yet here he is putting Isaacson up here as kind of the consummate Washington deal maker. Tom Graves was there too. He actually gave the introduction of Isaacson. Tom Graves went to Congress as a Tea Partier. I mean, he was elected that first generation of Tea Party elected officials, and he says this was Johnny Isaacson's
time. I can't
time.
Hear program.
Okay, well, David, we're going to fix that in our control room right now, and we'll get you back online. Go while we're waiting. Go ahead.
It was a very interesting shift in kind of Republican attitude.
Well, yeah, and Greg, I think it's important. I mean, if this suggests that the Republicans really do think that this little-known Democrat, Jim Barksdale, along with, you know, we've got a Libertarian candidate on the ticket, Alan Grayson.
Buckley,
are challenging. They're cutting into Johnny Isaacson's lead. So you have the Tea Party testifying that Isaacson is fine with them, even though a lot of people think of him as a moderate, and he's been criticized for that. And you've got a David Perdue willing to say compromise is a good thing.
Yeah, who are basically saying that about the embodiment of the establishment in Georgia. I mean, this is the father of, I guess, one of the fathers.
He and Coverdell would be considered the founding fathers of the GOP.
Of the modern Georgia GOP. And then, as Jim mentioned in the column, too, this was a stark contrast from back in 14 when we were both out of Macon. And it was David Perdue's big coming out. It was one of his first big public appearances, but also you had Michelle Nunn sharing the stage with him at the same event, right?
Right, right.
So it was a very much a more bipartisan signal. Now you're seeing the Republican establishment and non-establishment rally around Isaacson because they're worried about this January.
My recollection is that was the first time that Perdue and Nunn did they debate?
That was their first.
That's
yeah,
what
that, was,
I
that was their yeah, first. That was their first, that. First meeting.
Joint appearance. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. The other thing that I think is interesting that came out of or did not come out of Macon, Jim, is another issue that's a big one in the presidential race, and that's the TPP.
Right. Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Partnership, which an awful lot of Georgia business leaders, and the Georgia Chamber certainly is an organization driven by Georgia business leaders, a lot of whom do business in the global economy. Johnny Isaacson, nobody talked about it yesterday.
Nobody talked about it. Isaacson has said he is for a deal, but he's not committing to this particular deal. He wants to see some more specifics. David Perdue, by the way, has said the very same thing. My impression is that this is a box they don't want to open before November 8th. That opening this issue would give Jim Barksdale, the Democrat, some maneuvering room. It would give Alan Buckley a little chance to criticize him. So I think they're going to go radio silence on
Well,
this.
And of course, part of the reason for that, Greg, is that their candidate for president, the guy who's going to lead the ticket here in Georgia, Donald Trump, has said he's opposed to every trade deal, including TPP, and he'll get rid of NAFTA if he has
exactly.
a chance.
So
it doesn't do him any good to make statements one way or the other
now. Yeah, it's a fine line they're trying to walk. And we pressed David Perdue on that just a few days ago. And he said, listen, a deal is going to happen either way. I'd rather have it be an American-led deal than a Chinese-led deal. But still, he's trying very, very hard not to openly oppose the candidate he's enthusiastically endorsed. And same thing with Johnny Isaacson.
Now, the other thing that happened in Macon, of course, we had Charlie Cook and Stu Rothenberg, the D.C. political analyst there.
Whoa. We're having some real problems with our feed to Athens. It's interfering with our audio here. So I'll tell you what, let's do this. Are we in a position, Tyler, when we can take, are we okay now?
There we go.
All
there
right.
we go.
David, are you back with us?
Yeah, I hear you. You sound magnificent.
As do you. Give us a second, Jim. Finish what you were saying.
Yeah, we had Charlie Cook and Stu Rothenberg there, and both were kind of they were pretty blunt about Trump's chances in November. And I thought the interesting thing I thought was that I mean this you had maybe 2,000 people in this crowd. This was a big, it's always a big affair. There was no protest. That they were very accepting of Trump's chances. I think they were very very clued in.
These are two of the real graybeards in the political
and this is a
world.
Highly Republican audience in a highly red area of a red state, and there was not that much overt support for Donald Trump.
It's,
there.
I think you reported that Charlie Cook suggested that he thinks Clinton wins this 3.9 points over Trump.
Right. Yeah, he said Republicans would have been better off had they nominated a potted plant.
All right. Let's do this. We're getting ourselves reorganized in terms of our technology. I'm glad that you're back on the phone, David Hasinski. So let's take an early break today. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit about the state of journalism in this race. And we're going to bring in Martha Humphreys-Ginn, too, from Augusta University. She had an interesting op-ed piece in The Washington Post yesterday. And we're going to talk to her because it, too, relates to the way in which journalism is being practiced this time around. It's 2:16. You're listening to Political Rewind. Back after a message.
One Georgia County Health Department is emphasizing birth control as a way to combat a high rate of teen pregnancy.
Well, they won't come if they don't sense that they have confidentiality in a safe place.
Find out more about a teen-only center where girls can get pregnancy tests and birth control this afternoon on All Things Considered. GPB News, empowering you one story at a time.
We're back on Political Rewind again. We continue to use the music of Toots Thielemans, the great harmonica player who died this week in our transitions in the show. Let's bring in by telephone from Augusta and by Skype from Athens, David Hazinski in Athens, Martha Ginn in Augusta. David, let me start with you if I can.
Sure.
Just give us an overall, given how, from your perspective, now that you are out of the news, the current news business in this country, how is the media doing on covering this race?
I don't think so hot, to be honest with you. Where we are is in a completely different situation than when I was a correspondent. The public has changed. It's far more polarized. It is looking for media that reinforces its preconceived notions. And the media is completely different. The fairness doctrine that balanced coverage on broadcast went away. Now only 9% of Americans get their information and their broadcast information via an actual antenna. The news organizations, which used to have to justify themselves at public interest, are now corporately owned in almost all cases, and their responsibility is to their shareholders. So I think you see a completely different dynamic now than existed 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago. And I don't think it's particularly good. I have friends in the media now who say, look, the complaints that we're giving Donald Trump too much coverage is unjustified, because he actually is a story. And that's a completely legitimate argument. However, I have never seen a political candidate, when he was one of 16 people running for office, who would call a control room and they'd immediately put him on the air. They are aware that he generates ratings. They're concerned with ratings. They're not concerned with public interest. And I think that's obvious. But let me add a postscript to that. I think they have begun to change. The criticism has built up. The heat of the race has changed, and they are now starting to ask the questions they should have been asking of both candidates a year ago.
Okay.
Maybe too late. I don't know.
Martha, you have a different and interesting perspective on all this. Your op-ed piece yesterday in the Washington Post is headlined, "Here's Another Reason Not to Trust TV News Reports About Election Polls." What do you mean by that?
Well, what we're basically saying is that there's a universe of polls that the media can choose from, and that they don't always choose the ones that are the most accurate.
So let me be clear. You're not suggesting necessarily, you're not commenting on the accuracy necessarily of any given poll. You're talking about how various media organizations choose to play the poll results.
Exactly. So which polls they decide to cover as compared to ones that they don't cover. And what we see is we looked at the 2008 election, but what we saw there is that they covered the ones that showed a tighter race or ones that were very disparate. So when one candidate was surging ahead, and they didn't really accurately reflect that consistent lead that Barack Obama had at the time.
Well, you studied 2008, but do you think you're seeing a similar trend in 2016?
I think you are, and I think that you're seeing a play on national polls more than state polls, when really the state polls are what's going to determine the election because of the way the electoral map is laid out.
Well, it was a fascinating piece. I want to get everybody, David, Greg, Jim, into the mix here. And I'll throw this out. My sense is that we are so eager. We love polls so much that we report on every poll we can get our hands on without regard to whether it's dramatic or not. Jim, Greg, David?
Or the margin of error. We don't seem to report that enough, and that's a gigantic determination of whether the poll is accurate or not.
I think on TV, in TV reporting, I'd say maybe on network TV reporting, where time is such an issue, I think that's probably true. But if you look at more of the detailed Fox reporting or MSNBC reporting, yeah, the margin of error becomes an issue, and they do start to delve into the assumptions and the makeup of each poll. What I like, and what I do see people doing a lot more now is tapping into places like Real Clear Politics, yeah, where you aggregate several polls.
I was going to mention that. I mean, that's definitely a phenomenon we didn't see as much in 2008, which was the poll of polls.
But none of that relates to specifically what Martha and her co-writer on this piece had to say, which was, she's not talking yet about the accuracy of the polls or the congregating of poll data and coming up with an average. She's talking about her belief that we tend to give coverage to the polls that have some drama in them. And that's an interesting, Martha, I will tell you, we unabashedly report on every poll we can get our hands on here on Political Rewind.
Yeah, but look, I've got to make a confession. The more interesting a poll is, the more likely I am to talk about it,
okay,
or to report on it. And my definition of interesting is movement.
Martha?
Sure, well, that's part of what defines news.
Yeah. Right, and that's basically what we're arguing. And what we look at, I mean, a lot of, you know, news organizations have their internal polling sources, and they default to using them, obviously, because they have, you know, a stake in those polls. But what we looked at was, you know, what are all the polls out there they could have chosen? And then what we find is that the ones that they use are the ones that showed this tighter race and actually gave the American electorate a sense that the race was much tighter than it really was. So there are a lot of people who woke up the next day saying, you know, how did this election turn out the way that it did? I thought it was supposed to be close. So they want to cover this horse race that's neck and neck, or, you know, sometimes if one surges ahead, that's what they want to show. But they don't want to show the consistency. And I would agree that we look more at polls of polls or 538 now than we did in 2008. But it really was a difference between what the reality was, like if you looked at the Real Clear Politics average, and what was being covered in the polls on the, particularly the cable news network.
Greg, I don't think there's any question that coverage of an election campaign, we tend to follow a storyline. So the storyline coming out of the Democratic convention, that most news organizations, including ours and yours, was, my gosh, Hillary Clinton got a much bigger bump than Donald Trump did. She's surging because he's stepping all over his own tongue and not doing a particularly good job in allowing Clinton to have her problems highlighted by the news media. So it is fair to say that the next thing all of us, including voters, look for is there a comeback for Donald Trump?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's a storyline that's a legitimate storyline, but certainly one that we in the media always kind of look for.
I mean, that's one of the next upcoming narratives. As Donald Trump, can he stay on message? And as he stays on message, does that reflect, is Georgia going to stay as close? I mean, our poll, which I was going to mention too, we asked something like 25 questions, and we're lucky to get 7 or 8 different, and of course it's our poll, so we're writing more about it, but we're lucky to get 7 or 8 different stories out of those 20-something questions. So there's 15 questions that either had not that very interesting results or that we just kind of, you know, didn't report all about. Right. So that happens all the time.
All right. Hey, Martha, again, we really appreciate your joining us from Augusta, and congratulations on getting a lot of attention for your piece in yesterday's Washington Post. We know you have to get off to a meeting or whatever's going on with you right out there, but we thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay. David Huszynski, let's keep talking about media for a couple more minutes, okay? Are
sure.
You there? So, and of course, Greg and Jim, I want to get you into the mix here. Last week, Jim, on this show Friday, we played a pretty long excerpt from Sean Hannity's show, one of a number of shows he's done lately, in which he has been pushing this scenario pretty relentlessly that Hillary Clinton has some significant health problems. And one of the reasons we thought it was worth paying attention to is because Trump himself has indicated that he wants to get a piece of that action as well. And just this week, the other day, Rudy Giuliani started the drumbeat on this sweat, too.
I think Hillary's tired.
I do.
When I saw Hillary at the press conference sitting down with the police, with a Democrat-appointed police chief, pretending she's pro-police, it was one of the most pathetic press conferences I've ever seen.
What do you mean?
Well, first of all, she looked sick. Number two, she looked completely uncomfortable saying anything pro-police. And number three, it was a complete joke because she was surrounded by four or five Democratic-appointed political police chiefs. We know. Just go ask any cop right out there. We know who the police are supporting.
So in trying to get to a point criticizing Hillary Clinton for having a meeting with police, he couldn't help but address how sick Hillary Clinton looks. Jim Ruttenberg wrote a piece for The Times this week. He does a lot of media writing, elaborating on Sean Hannity's involvement with the Trump campaign. Greg, they just had a town meeting the other night. Hannity says, "I'm not a journalist," but he acknowledges he's giving advice privately.
But he plays one on TV.
So a toss-up question. What do we make of this sort of arrangement, any of you?
It's uncomfortable. I mean, but the other point we have to keep in mind, too, is Sean Hannity's a ratings juggernaut for Fox News. So there's no incentive for Fox News to rein him in anymore, especially not during the cycle, when he's become basically a surrogate of Donald Trump.
David, what do you tell your students? You have a lot of students out there. You work with them to create a daily newscast at UGA. How do you talk to them about a guy like Hannity?
Well, some of them want to be Hannity. They've come from this kind of background, and they know it. And some of them are actually shocked by what we teach them, in that we have to instill balance and do first source confirmation of stories, and that opinion is not news necessarily. It is singularly that. But I think a lot of them get it. What I find, and we've been talking about our own election coverage and what we're going to do, is they're very interested in politics and they know very little about it. In some cases, they're saying, look, we don't want to vote at all. So we'll be happy to help people understand their ballots better and to cover the balloting. But this is just too crazy for us.
I have no problem with asking a presidential candidate to hand over his or her health records. But if you're going to demand it of another candidate, you got to do it yourself first. And I'm willing to demand Hillary Clinton's health records if Donald Trump will show me his health records. It's the same thing. This is the same thing.
Doctor. He said he's in wonderful condition. That was it.
But that was it. That was it. It was yeah. This is the same issue on the tax returns. Hillary Clinton released her tax returns in large part so she could demand them of Donald Trump.
Right. Exactly.
You know, but none of these things matter because we're not talking about policies. We're not talking about a normal race. We're talking about the politics of personality. And we have two very strong personalities with a public that has deep-seated opinions about both of them. And we have a media that is playing off that narrative, not off what we hope a president will do that will determine policies and will defend the nation. We don't talk about that at all. We just talk about the personalities.
Greg, that is a criticism that David raises that we hear every election cycle, that we're focused on the horse race, that we're not focused on the issues. And there is certainly a kernel of truth in that, no question. But your job, and you are the lead political reporter. I don't know if that's your title, but you're the one whose byline is out there constantly. You have to cover what the campaign is doing day in and day out. Now, maybe there should be another set of reporters who are back in Sandy Springs or Dunwoody, wherever you are. who are digging into position papers. Are there positions on issues? But your job really is to cover what's going on in the campaigns, yes?
Yeah, and every day, we everyone who's covering politics here at the AJC or anywhere, we have to do a sort of a balancing act. Because there's the, you know, surrogate today, there was a few emails from saying that David Perdue and Bob Barr both have calling for a special prosecutor to look into Hillary Clinton. So there's the day-to-day daily news, but there's also the broader context we've got to keep an eye on. And we also know there's some stories we're writing that there's just not going to be any interest in. There are certain stories we write that we say, this is going to get thousands upon thousands of clicks. And others, I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues. I said, we have to do this. I don't know if anyone's going to read it, but it's the fundamental campaign reporting, the stuff that we have to do.
But I'll disagree with you, Bill. I think this campaign journalistically is far more concentrated on the personality than any I've ever any I've ever been involved in, and in part, you know, the candidates are pushing us toward this. I mean, my goodness, have you gone to the Donald Trump website and tried to scope out a particular a policy position? I mean, what we're going through right now with Trump and immigration, just getting down to the very, very basics of what he means when he says that 11 million people have to leave the United States. How will he enforce that? We sense some shifting on that, but we don't see it actually.
That's a good point. How do we write a story about immigration policy when he says, when the latest statement from the campaign says we want to have a fair immigration policy, but it's going to be not what he said back in January.
Right, right.
And, you know, there really is some very good reporting going on. The Associated Press is taking a part of Hillary Clinton's record as Secretary of State. CNN has looked into Trump's background, as has USA Today. It's been really excellent reporting, and it really hasn't bubbled to the top. It's a flash story that's gone in 18 hours.
David, I'm sorry. I'm gonna do this. You had the last word before we take a break. We are gonna break right now. And David, I hope you'll stay with us. We are gonna talk now about the Clinton Foundation and the revelations that are very troubling for her campaign, and then have given Trump some opportunities against her right now. When we come back, this is Political Rewind. It's 2:33. We'll be back in a moment.
Hello, I'm Renee Montaigne. You're probably familiar with public radio fundraising idioms like pledge, donate, you put the public in public radio, that sort of thing. Here's a new one, unwanted vehicle. Yes, in addition to donations from listeners, this station will accept your unwanted vehicle. In fact, it could be worth hundreds of dollars to the station. And here is how to learn more.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
So how you doing?
I feel great.
You know, I've been Googling brain tumors. A lot more common than you think.
John Krasinski, who co-starred in The Office, directed and stars in the new film The Hollers, about a family dealing with the illness of its matriarch, played by Margot Martindale. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Krasinski about the film and his 9 seasons on The Office. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. A little more Toot Steelman's, but Jim, I'm sorry, we don't have Midnight Cowboy theme.
I'll live.
A link to that on our website, okay, so people can go click and hear him do that number. We have David Krasinski joining us. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Georgia in Athens. He's joining us by Skype. Greg Bluestein of the AJC is in the studio. And, of course, as always, Jim Galloway is here to keep me on track. Jim, you know, it's been, I should say you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. And of course, Ted B., who is the conscience of this show as often as he can be, says, so now navel gazing about media treatment of the race is what's keeping you from covering AP's Clinton Foundation and email stories. Thank you for that, Ted. Jim, there have been some big revelations this
week. There
have
been. I mean, the FBI has found, what, 15,000 new emails? And we're now just getting a schedule for how they will be released between now and November 8th. What they will contain, we don't know. It's almost hard to get excited about yet another 10,000 emails. But I will tell you, I was most, the eye-opener for me was this AP story that took a look at, of Hillary Clinton's non-governmental visitors as Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. Well over half of them were donors to the Clinton Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like 84 of 150 something. I think I don't have the numbers in front of me.
You know, and now we have the foundation saying that if she's elected, they're going to spin off the foundations and they're going to try to get out of that business. You know, my question, of course, is if it's a conflict of interest when you're president, isn't it a conflict of interest when you're Secretary of State?
Yeah, USA Today actually is editorializing in this morning's paper that it is time for the Clinton Foundation to go out of business, to turn over their assets to another nonprofit that can do the same charitable work that they do. Greg, yeah. David, this is all this does is drive up people's suspicions of Hillary Clinton, yes?
Yeah, but here's something that I think hasn't been covered. We haven't really taken a good look at the Clinton Foundation. When Donald Trump says play for pay, that usually implies that a business is involved and someone's getting a great deal of money because of some influence they've peddled. But the Clinton Foundation does a lot of charitable work, and it's completely normal for governments to work with NGOs or foundations or faith-based organizations to do things. We haven't even looked at the Clinton Foundation. I don't remember a story that took it apart and said, this is what it does, and this is where it goes, and this is how it's
modeled. Yeah, and Greg, I think that David just set me up for the question I wanted to ask you. The Clinton Foundation, the Clinton campaign had to know that all of this was out there.
Right.
Far earlier, these are the pros. These are not the Trump campaign people, which everybody's been saying they're new to this. They don't know what they're doing. They could have anticipated months ago this and started to put out word about the vast good work that that foundation does do around the world. They never did it. They're caught flat-footed.
They haven't made the argument.
Right, yeah. Right.
Or at least started to distance, you know, or made the announcement they made today that Hillary Clinton wouldn't be involved and that Chelsea Clinton might still be involved. Started to distance themselves a little bit more from it. And also that line of thinking, too. I mean, Trump will, if he stays on message this week, will continually call for a special prosecutor to investigate both the Clinton's emails and the involvement with the Clinton Foundation while she ran the State Department over and over again. So as long as he stays on message, you'll hear more about that. You'll be hearing more of a push to look deeper into what the Clinton Foundation's actually doing.
So, you know, Donald Trump is staying out of the way of this story, and he is out there right now hammering away at Hillary Clinton. Let's listen to just one of the things he said on the campaign trail the other night.
Justice is supposed to be blind. It's never supposed to be for sale. Hillary Clinton thinks she's above the law. Come November, the American people will show her that she is not.
All right. Donald Trump, Jim Galloway, this is a new Trump. He didn't say anything that would take the attention away from this focus on Clinton.
No, he didn't. He kept it up. But you know, we are still not seeing a basic rule of politics being followed in that Donald Trump right now ought to be selling himself. He ought not to be the attack dog in a two-person team. That should be the role of a surrogate. It should be the role of Mike Pence, but Donald Trump should be selling himself at this point.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to speculate. Okay. I label it as speculation. So if you are the new Trump campaign team, right? Mm-hmm. If you're Kellyanne or maybe even Steve Bannon. One of the things you have to do with Trump loves going after people. He loves attacking people. So it's the Muslim family who dare speak out against him. It's any number of enemies that he was used to be going after. I think the only reason, Greg, they could have sold him on this approach was if they said, oh, go ahead, be an attack dog, but aim it all at Hillary.
We just keep it to Hillary or to Obama. I think Obama is probably a number two that he could keep on going to. But no, that's his nature. And you saw that again and again, even during the DNC. Before he attacked the Kazir Khan family, he went after Mike Bloomberg, he went after Tim Kaine. So the New York Times kept the tally of all the people he's insulted on Twitter or in person, and it was more than, 200?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but that's him at his element, and he keeps on going back to the fact that that's what helped them win the primary. Don't take that pugilistic nature away from him.
Yeah, that's right. I think, David, this is a great point that Jim starts us down the road on, and that is, he may be driving up her negatives, but he's doing nothing. Even the tone of the way he's talking does nothing to help people like him anymore, right?
Well, it may not have them like him anymore, but it's bringing up an issue that will make people question her as president as well. And it's almost negative versus negative. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious now that this email issue is not going to go away even when she's elected. And that actually puts a Hillary Clinton administration in a position where they're going to have to concentrate on defending themselves legally from these issues. And I think that will make people question whether or not she would be the right choice for president. So, everyone has looked at this election and said it's how much you hate the person the least.
You've got two separate candidates with historically high unfavorable ratings. You've got, I talked to State Senator Renee Underman, a Republican from Gwinnett County, and she said she's, not in love with Trump, but to her it's a choice between bad and worse. You know, that's what we're hearing from voter after voter after voter. It's who's least like the less.
Well, we now also, Jim, to follow up on that, have the most high profile, the highest visibility member of the state legislature so far to express public doubts about whether Trump is a viable candidate or whether he wants Trump to be president. And that's State Representative Alan Peake, who is, I think, because of the way he fought the medical marijuana battle, has become a relatively beloved figure across the state.
Right, right. Now, let's let Greg talk to this because he's the one who actually talked to Alan.
Yeah, I mean, Representative Peake, he's a Macon Republican, he's a restaurateur with some sort of higher office aspirations, said openly, he said, listen, I know this might tank my political future, but I believe that if the Republican Party under Trump keeps on going down the path it is, which is alienating Hispanics over immigration and gays and lesbians over transgender bathroom rights and whatever, he listed several more policies, then I think we're on the verge of extinction as a Republican Party as we know it. We've got to turn this around now is his plea. And he got hammered. He got a lot of praise. He got a lot of attacks on social media because of it. But he became the first Republican, prominent Republican that we know of to really vocally raise doubts about Trump in that sort of way.
On the other hand, you have another Georgia Republican, Greg, Jack Kingston, who has, over his years in Congress, I mean, he's always been a conservative, no question about that. But he was incredibly popular on the Hill among Republicans and Democrats. Mm-hmm. He's funny. He's charming. He knows how to reach out across the aisle.
He was on the House Appropriations Committee.
That doesn't hurt your popularity. And suddenly he's become a really rabid Trump advocate in the media surrogate.
Yeah, we're starting to see a sort of different side of Jack Kingston. When he was running for Senate in 2014, he'd remind people that even in the first district in Savannah, he got a significant chunk of Democratic votes, mostly from African Americans in that district. And now he's become a senior Trump advisor, and he had a pretty bad gaffe on CNN on Friday when he was asked whether or not he was pressed on why Trump isn't going to black audiences, and he said something to the effect of, well, what do you want him to go in front of a burning car or something? And that just did not play very well for Kingston, who also has his eye on a higher office in Georgia.
Right, and just in the history is at work here a little bit, because Jack Kingston, of course, was got himself into a runoff with David Perdue, who we talked about earlier in the show. He was Perdue was the outsider. Kingston was the Chamber of Commerce candidate, and I think you have Jack playing against his type right now in order to maybe ease the way for that next bid for office.
David, we have a tweet from Patty Kosh, who says, why are journalists not concerned that they have no access to Hillary Clinton? We've repeated this. She hasn't had a news conference in almost half a year, if not more.
Since December.
Since December.
200 days, something like that.
Should we be worried about that, David?
Sure, of course we should. We have a presidential candidate who is essentially hiding from questions from the media, and we have a presidential candidate who is jumping into every conversation he possibly can get into. Neither one of those are particularly good scenarios for giving the public information. And why is the media not pressing harder? I don't know. I completely agree with the tweet.
You know, here's one of the things that fascinates me about what's going on right now with the emails and the Clinton Foundation story that AP has had. These are the kinds of stories that when they've been aimed at Donald Trump and problems with Trump, he has jumped up immediately, responded to, sometimes angrily, tweeted out about them. What's fascinating is from Clinton, radio silence. Mm-hmm. She is giving no opportunity for, she's just not talking about it.
Their tactic is clearly to keep their head down.
It's a play it safe strategy, because through their calculations, if you look at, I don't know, any of the latest projections, she's already well above the 270, or she's already well above the electoral mark she needs. She's at 290, 300 in some of them. I'm not saying that's going to stick, but they're playing it safe. They're just
If I could just disabuse some of our Twitter followers out there, you know, that when they assume that all journalists are fans of Clinton's, look, you know, I remember the 90s. I was in the 90s. and I remember how hard it was to cover the Bill Clinton White House. It was that, yeah. I mean, they were, this is not a family that's free with information.
I was covering the White House. On the day that Clinton, this is a story you may remember. On the day that Clinton was inaugurated, we all came back to the White House afterward, and we were quickly told that George Stephanopoulos, then the press secretary, was discontinuing daily press briefings. And that lasted, for about 3 days. The outrage was so extreme.
But there have been, and I've seen a ton of stories, a plethora of stories, on a lot of these are insidery stories that might not get national media, but on the fact that, she hasn't had a press conference. She has nothing. She does not have yet a protective pool, which is very insidery jargon, but that's a pool of reporters around her that can track her every move and then send it back to the wider range of reporters. So there's lots of stories on that, but it's hard for those to come to reach above the din of the other stories out there.
All right. Well, Galen Jacobs triggers another conversation, at least a brief one, in her tweet. She says, to backtrack some, where was the outrage of personal email use of Secretary Rice and Colin Powell? Now it seems to be a big deal. Well, except that when Hillary Clinton this week made the pronouncement that it was Colin Powell that suggested to her she use private email.
And that didn't work out well.
Yeah, it didn't work out well, did it, David? What happened?
Well, he said, yes, I don't remember talking about it, but the dinner we talked about was a year after she started using her own private email server.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I don't get it.
He never used a private server as Hillary Clinton did. And you know, Jim, for a candidate who is trying to reach across the aisle and encourage Republican leaders who are more presumably moderate to join her campaign, you know, getting into it with Colin Powell isn't a really smart move.
That was a dumb move. But again, this is,
well, if he got along with it, it would have been great. Because he's such a highly respected Republican.
True.
Colin Powell has been used before. He doesn't like
yes,
it.
He has.
All right, let's turn with a little time. We do have some time left in the show today, and I want to talk a little bit about Donald Trump and this We referred to it briefly. This new Donald Trump we are supposed to be seeing out there on the campaign trail, it's manifesting itself, I think, in two main ways, and you can all take issue if you want. But one of them is certainly he's trying to figure out where they stand on immigration. But also this alleged outreach to the African-American community. And you've all heard this, but let's listen briefly to one of the ways in which Trump is trying to do that.
The Democrats have failed completely in the inner cities. Poverty, rejection, horrible education, no housing, no homes, no ownership, crime at levels that nobody's seen. You can go to war zones in countries that we're fighting, and it's safer than living in some of our inner cities. To the African Americans, who I employ so many people, to the Hispanics, tremendous people. What the hell do you have to lose? Give me a chance.
Okay, I'm a white guy, but if I were an African-American voter, I'm not sure this is the way I would like my community to be described to me.
Well, those were remarks by a man who doesn't have the vocabulary to talk to or about African
Americans. Well, not to mention that he's doing it in front of all white crowds.
Exactly.
It's fascinating to see the panoply of white supporters behind him when he makes comments like
that. I don't think that this is an outreach to African Americans or Hispanics. I think this is an outreach to Republican women who have been so turned off by his language that, you know, he's, you know, they're just begging him, please convince us that you're not what you sound like.
Greg, I like to remind our listeners every chance we get to talk about this subject that it was here on this show that Leo Smith, the director of minority engagement at the Republican Party in Georgia, told Jim Galloway he was going to get 20% of the African-American vote in Georgia, and Galloway has a bet with him on that.
A beer, right?
Yeah, but I think it was 25%.
No, he said 20. He said 20.
20. Okay. He said 20.
All right, okay.
It's hard enough, Jim. Don't make it even harder.
Let's get the facts straight.
Listen, at this point, though, I think the Trump campaign privately would look at what Romney got as a, which was about 8%,
7 or 8%,
7 or 8% as a success. I mean, the AJC poll, speaking of polls earlier, showed that he's at about 5 or 6% in Georgia.
With a margin of error of 4.5.
So it could be 1, it could be 9. But still, it shows him having a long way to go to get anywhere close to 20.
All right. The Clinton campaign this week, although, you know, we're going to see how they fight off this the stuff they're dealing with on the emails and the foundation. But, of course, they continue their very expensive ad campaign against Donald Trump in battleground states. They're spending a ton of money. Greg, the Trump campaign continues to spend virtually nothing. I think they put $5 million into five battleground states this week. We played the spot they're running on the air in those states, which is not an outreach spot. It's a secure the base spot. Mm-hmm. It's a message designed to appeal strictly to Republican voters. They want to come out, which may, at this stage in the race, may not be the best way to go anymore.
Although, I mean, if he's still having trouble consolidating his base,
well, right,
you've got to go both ways.
Yeah, I think the commercial tells us that.
Yeah.
Let's listen to the latest Hillary Clinton spot.
In times of crisis, America depends on steady leadership.
Knock the crap out of him, would you? Seriously.
Clear thinking.
I know more about ISIS than the generals do, believe me.
And calm judgment.
And you can tell them to go themselves.
Because all it takes is one wrong move.
I would bomb the shit out of them.
Just one.
David Hisinski, the jets flying overhead, ready for war. It reminds us of the Goldwater, the anti-Goldwater spot, the little girl picking the daisy and the mushroom cloud.
Nuclear, yep.
How do you think a spot like that plays out your way in Athens?
Well, Athens is a little freaky all by itself. A little spot of blue in a sea of red. So I think inside it plays well, and outside. I think these spots, by the way, are extremely well done and extremely effective and make the point very well in an appeal to emotion. I don't know who their ad agency is, but they're really good at it.
Jim?
Well, you know, it's we've got this turn in the campaign coming that maybe we might not have seen. You know, well, we probably saw it coming, maybe 5 or 6 months out. But we are pivoting toward foreign affairs in a presidential contest, which is kind of unusual. Usually, presidential campaigns are generally run one on domestic policy,
especially
and
the economy, right?
And we're about to see a post Labor Day shift to who would be the better commander in chief, and I think this is laying the groundwork for that.
And this is also when Hillary's huge fundraising advantage plays into effect too, right? I mean, we've already been seeing, if you were watching the Olympics, you already saw a litany of Hillary Clinton ads and not a single Donald Trump ad on air. And you're going to see more and more of that because her super PAC supporting her campaign already has about $40 million in donations and other $44 million in commitments. That's 80 plus million. Donald Trump's super PACs have about $4 million combined.
All right. We have an interesting a tweet from Thought Crime. He says, as a black man, and he's talking about Trump's comments about African-American voters, it doesn't offend me. Baltimore, Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, Flint, Detroit, been run by Democrats since the 1950s. And then a second tweet says, plus, this is the TV age. The audience doesn't matter. He's talking now about the live audience at the speech. But you know what? Come on. I've heard the campaign make that statement, too, the Trump campaign. Of course it matters whether you go into black communities or not, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican.
If you're asking for black votes and you haven't been to a black church yet,
yeah,
then you're not really serious, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So we're just about at the end of our time today. And first of all, David Huszynski, it's really been a pleasure to have you on from Athens. I hope you'll come back and join us for another Political Rewind as the campaign moves on. So first of all, thank you for being a guest today.
My pleasure.
Greg Bluestein, it's always fun to have you here.
Glad you're out there.
I mean, Galloway does all the writing back in the office. You're out there every day covering this thing.
No. Greg does all the work.
All right.
Bill Clinton tonight.
We'll be, it's a private fundraiser, but you're going to tell
we're trying to track him down. I'm checking my text right now.
All right. But he is coming in to raise money for Hillary Clinton. Do you have any preview of what your column is tomorrow, Jim Galloway?
The connection between mosques moving into small southern cities and Donald Trump.
We are going to have to do more with that Newton County story. That is a huge story, and I think you're so right to connect it to the way Trump has been talking and whipping up a frenzy about Muslims.
And we got some people we got to bring in to talk about it.
Okay, right, exactly. Thank you for that. Tomorrow night, Jim Galloway and I are trying something brand new that you'll hear on the air here Friday at Political Rewind's 3 p.m. show. We have got a voter panel, essentially a focus group coming in. Some are undecided. Some are leaning one way or the other. And we're going to talk to them and hear what they have to say. You hear from us all the time, but in the long run, you're the ones who matter as voters how this election turns out. So that'll be on Friday's Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. We've been playing the harmonica music of Toots Thielman because he passed away this week at age 94. But you know what? He's not the only harmonica player out there. Vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine knows how to play the harmonica. Let's go out with him.
Hey, I'm Tim Kaine. Good morning, Washington. And to wake you up,